from KQED.
I was in middle school when I first heard about the Donner Party. And like most kids, I was particularly interested in the ghoulish Cliff Notes. A group of migrants traveling to California get stuck in a surprise October snowstorm, then eat each other to survive. Whew. It's an eerie tale, even if these days you only know the Donner Party for the cannibal punchlines. But if you've ever been over Donner Pass near Lake Tahoe, you'll know. This infamous disaster happened not so far from our home in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's what made this Bay Curious listener reach out to us with her question.
My name is Afifa Twill, and I want to know how the Donner Party impacted the Bay Area.
This story is a big one, so we've got a two-parter for you. In this episode, part one, we'll learn what happened to those 81 people up in the mountains, where hope turned to misery, and misery became desperation. We'll also uncover a part of the story that you may not have heard about. I'm Olivia Allen Price, and you're listening to Bay Curious.
Support for Bay Curious comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, committed to brewing things the right way since 1980, because when you're a family-run brewery, there's no other way to do it. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, still family-owned, operated, and argued over. And be sure to stay tuned through the end of the show so you can play our monthly trivia game for a chance to win some cool prizes.
When we go outside, we often find wonder and inspiration.
Less than a mile in, I rounded this bend and I froze in place.
You just feel like you belong with the universe.
I'm Willow Belden, the host of Out There, a podcast that tells intimate stories about life-changing experiences in the outdoors. Out There is this month's PRX KQED Community Spotlight. Learn more at kqed.org/spotlight.
Our question asker, Afifa Twill, wants to know what impact the Donner Party saga had on the Bay Area, because for a lot of her life, she didn't actually think of it as a local story. But in many ways, it shaped California during a pivotal moment in our history. To understand how, we need to start at the very beginning. Reporter Carly Severn takes us there.
The story of the Donner Party has to start with the land they risked everything to reach almost two centuries ago, California. They came to claim this place, but this wasn't empty land. Before European colonization, California was home to an estimated 300,000 indigenous people, from the Washoe tribe of the area around Lake Tahoe to the Ohlone in what is now San Francisco. The wider Bay Area alone was home to many long-standing tribes with incredibly diverse cultures and languages.
First, I'd like to introduce myself in our Miwok language. So, Michuxis, Kuchayama, Kaniayase, Dalton Brown. Hello, good day. My name's Dalton Brown.
Dalton is a member of the Wilton Rancheria tribe outside Sacramento. His ancestors, the Miwok and Nisenan people of this region, are a part of the Donner Party story that often gets left out. It was their land that settlers were trying to reach.
It was a bountiful, bountiful place where communities were free to trade, free to interact. Hundreds of thousands and millions of acres of space to provide for our communities. And really, no restrictions on existence.
And into this land traveled people like the Donner Party. White migrants, settlers, who came from the Midwest and walked over these mountains in the 1800s on their way to make new lives here in California. Long before the railroad, before gold even, these settlers made the journey with animals and wagons full of everything they owned. And the California they were traveling to wasn't actually part of the United States then. In 1846, this was Mexico. This area was known as Alta California and wouldn't become officially part of the U.S. for another 4 years. So back then, what made these migrants think they could just pack up, relocate their entire families and everything they owned, and have this land for their own? Greg Palmer is the resident expert at the museum that now stands at the site of the Donner Party horror up in the Sierras.
I've been a Donner Party historian since 1992.
And he says the answer to why they came is simple.
This is the era of manifest destiny. President James Polk has propagated the idea that it's our divine right and duty to build the country coast to coast after the Louisiana Purchase.
The notion that this land was home for the indigenous people who'd lived here for centuries, or that it was legally Mexican territory, none of this concerned these self-styled pioneers. They saw an escape from unfavorable situations in their own homelands and real estate opportunities.
There's a lot of disease, cholera, malaria. A lot of people got sick and died. So many people prior to gold were moving west for a more healthful environment.
The Donner Party wasn't just one family called Donner. It was a blended bunch of multiple families, plus some lone travelers, all bound together on a journey of over 1,000 miles west, joining many other migrants and traveling in one long, snaking party of wheels and livestock along what was called the Oregon Trail, through the grasslands of Illinois, across the desert, and finally over the mountains into California.
That year of travel, 1846-47, literally opened the floodgates of people coming to California, and this is still before Gold Rush. But that same season, hundreds of wagons and thousands of people made the trip.
There was a Donner family, two brothers, George and Jacob Donner, and their many kids. You might have also heard this called the Donner Reed Party, and that's because there was a Reed family, James and Margaret Reed, and their children. On top of them, you had the Breen family from Ireland, the Graves clan, the Keysburg family. They'd all either set out together or wound up teaming up on the road together. But the majority of the Donner Party weren't the hardscrabble travelers you might be conjuring in your mind.
In the 1840s, to go overland to California or Oregon, you know, poor people couldn't do it. They couldn't afford it.
Aside from the hired hands along for the ride, these families on the trail had money and land already. They just wanted more of it. So if there were a lot of folks making this journey west that year, what made the Donner Party different? Put simply, they were the only travelers on the trail in spring 1846 who collectively decided not to follow the trusted path into California with all of those others, but to take a chance on a new route. By 1846, migration west had become an industry, and any industry attracts its grifters. One of those was a guy called Lansford Hastings. He'd written a guide to making the journey into California that told travelers of a cutoff, a shortcut he promised would save them weeks. The problem? This route was a scam, based on guesswork. Hastings' guide only recommended it because it would divert travelers into places where he had money-making schemes set up to profit off them.
The so-called Hastings cutoff, which he had never been on when he wrote the book, turned out, instead of a shortcut, cutting out 300 to 400 miles, added 30 days to the journey of the Donners because they had to hack the road themselves.
And the thing was, they were already too late. Hastings' terrible guide had gotten one thing right. In order not to cross the Sierra Nevada in the snow, any travelers needed to leave the Midwest at the right time. As Hastings wrote,
"Unless you pass over the mountains early in the fall, you are very liable to be detained by impassable mountains of snow until the next spring, or perhaps forever."
By the time members of the Donner Party left, they were already 3 weeks late. As the last wagons on the trail, their fate was sealed. And this is the thing about the Donner Party that you might not know. This band of travelers was a mess even before they reached any snow. The extra weeks and miles on their journey meant they were already running out of food, says Greg Palmer.
In addition to hacking the road through the Wasatch Mountains, they had to cross the Great Salt Lake Desert, which purportedly, by Hastings, was 40 miles. It was 80 miles. It took them over a week to get across it, and they lost countless number of cattle and oxen and livestock. The oxen are the engines pulling your wagons.
People were dying before they even reached the Sierras. As the Donner Party desperately pulled their wagons over steep rock, 19th century road rage kicked in. And James Reed shot another man dead. For this, Reed was banished, released into the wilderness to make his own way to California without his family, who stayed behind. But this isn't the last we'll be hearing of James Reed in this saga. Reed wasn't the only one to leave the wagon trail. When it became clear that things were already going very wrong, two other men were sent out ahead of the wagons and all those people. Their mission was to get supplies to bring back to the desert, at a place where Sacramento is now, called Sutter's Fort, ruled over by a man called John Sutter, a man who you'll hear about in this Donner Party story again and again. If his name's familiar to you, he's the colonizer from Switzerland whose statue in Sacramento was torn down this year. Sutter's Fort, his giant ranch, was his miniature empire, and it represented the kind of opportunity that the Donner Party hoped to find in the California sun. But to the indigenous people whose land he'd claimed, Dalton Brown's own Miwok and Nisenan ancestors, this place held only loss and pain.
Indigenous people were resources to be used for the benefit of others.
Sutter first courted the local people to work at his fort, and when he met those who wouldn't, he brutally forced them into what a visiting settler called a complete state of slavery.
You know, the man burnt down Miwok and Nisenan roundhouses as a way of motivating people to work harder. And, you know, that's the equivalent of burning down somebody's church.
When the two men from the Donner Party reached Sutter's Fort, they were given those life-saving supplies to take back to the rest of the party in the desert. And because John Sutter liked to flex his power to white visitors, he also sent two young Miwok men from the fort with them to help take the supplies back to the Donner Party and to stay with them. Their names, given to them when they were converted to Catholicism by the Spanish missionaries, were Luis and Salvador. We don't know much about them, or whether they labored by choice at Sutter's Fort. Their story often gets lost in the Donner Party saga. But given what happened to them next, we're going to follow their story. The food Luis and Salvador helped deliver back to the desert from John Sutter saved the Donner Party. And after multiple weeks in the baking heat, this hungry group finally reached the granite cliffs of the Sierra Nevada, just as it was starting to snow. This exhausted crew of 81 people rested where Reno is now and then edged slowly towards where Truckee now lies, far too slowly.
It could be said that if they rested up for 4 or 5 days in Reno, down the hill from us, had they left one day earlier, they might have made it.
Because here, this group filled with families with young children was attacked by a shockingly early snowstorm that kept piling snow as high as 15 feet deep on the ground around them. And it wouldn't stop. You might have been in a place like Tahoe when bad weather hits, but the snowstorms most of us have seen in our lives are nothing compared to what the Donner Party saw in October 1846. It was snow that literally buried them where they stood. And when they realized they could not go any further, they made camp at the place where Donner Memorial State Park now lies, by Donner Lake, right below Interstate 80. But a quarter of them, including the Donner family themselves, were stuck miles behind at a place called Alder Creek.
So even though the party is the Donner Party and this is Donner Lake, they didn't even make it this far.
That snow lasted for days. And this is when the real ordeal began. The Donner Party started desperately constructing shelter from the elements. Some had the strength to fashion rough cabins, but in the unbelievable conditions, others managed nothing more than lean-to tents.
A couple of sticks laid up against the trunk of a tree and then put buffalo robes and canvas over those.
The families of the Donner Party built their cabins and shelters startlingly far apart. After 6 months of chaos and violence on the trail, these people were sick of the sight of each other.
So by this time, there's no love lost between the families. It's every family out for themselves, to hell with anybody else.
Already running dangerously low on provisions, the travelers trapped in the snow killed the last of their oxen for food, eating first the meat and then their hides. A few attempted to travel through the snow to the other side of the mountain, but the snow was just too deep. The patriarch of the Breen family, Patrick Breen, started keeping a diary. It's the only first-person account of the Donner Party horror written at the time that's seen the light of day.
Snowing fast. Snow higher than the shanty. Must be 13 feet deep. Don't know how to get wood this morning. It's dreadful to look at.
A true battle for survival had begun. And all around them, as the days turned to weeks, the freezing snow just kept coming.
Provisions getting very scant. People getting weak, living on short allowance of hides.
The camps were filled with children of all ages, enduring one of the most traumatic events imaginable. Eliza Donner was the youngest child in the Donner family, and she was only 3 years old at the time. She survived and eventually wrote a memoir of the terrible isolation up there in the Sierras.
Oh, it was painfully quiet some days in those great mountains. And lonesome upon the snow. The pines had a whispering, homesick murmur, and we children had lost all inclination to play.
Inside their makeshift cabins, where families huddled, weakened by hunger to escape the elements, it was dark and increasingly fetid, especially when people started to die.
Days at a time, sequestered in the cabins. You can use your imagination and imagine just how gross that was. You know, from sanitary things to a corpse laying in the corner over there.
After a month and a half, it became clear that if anyone was going to survive, someone needed to go for help. So in mid-December of 1846, a band of the strongest people in the Donner Party strapped on makeshift snowshoes, said goodbye to their families, and hiked away high onto the peaks above Donner Lake to cross the mountains. With them were Luis and Salvador, the two Miwok men that John Sutter had delivered into this grueling ordeal. And if things at the camps were bad, things out there, fully exposed to the elements, got so much worse very quickly.
The first occurrence of the cannibalism didn't happen here or at Alder Creek. It happened on the snowshoe trek going over the mountains.
This small party desperately pressed on with bleeding feet, virtually blinded by the glare of the snow. One by one, they began to die. And because it was way too far to turn back, for the first time, the famished, freezing snowshoe party started to talk about the possibility of sustaining themselves on human flesh. And when a third man died, the remaining survivors finally took that step, stripped his bones for flesh, and began to eat it. And here's the thing. You'll often hear people say that as horrible as the cannibalism of the Donner Party was, at least they only ate the flesh of folks who'd already died and never killed anyone for food. But unfortunately, that's not true. And as Dalton Brown of Wilton Rancheria reminds us, it all comes down to who gets to write history.
The way the story has been shaped and evolved over time, it really shows you where emphasis was placed when it came to human life.
When the snowshoe party started to eat their dead, accounts confirm Luis and Salvador were the only ones to refuse, even though they themselves were dying of hunger.
And that was culturally taboo and an absolute no. So when they refused and said, no, we're not eating that, obviously they became weaker.
Seeing their strength waning, that's when one of the men in the Donner Party murdered Luis and Salvador with his gun. so that the rest of the party could eat their bodies and keep themselves alive.
While John Setter thought he was sending a couple people up there to help this party get down, he was sending them up there as a sacrifice, whether or not he knew it. And they were treated as no different than any animal the party may have come across. And it's just incredible to me to reflect on that and think that that rationale was sound in their mind as a reason to take those two lives.
In the 1990s, a historian called Joseph King used records at Mission San Jose, where he believed Luis and Salvador had been converted. From this, he believes that Salvador might have been a Miwok of the Kasumne tribelet, whose birth name was Uyuyun, and that he'd have been around 28 years old when he was murdered. King believed Luis might have been an Okahamne Miwok, with the birth name Iimo, and that he was just 19 when he was killed for food.
These men's story deserves to be told, and even finding historical records who these men were, which villages they came from, is almost impossible now. They've really almost been erased from history.
Having gained food from murder, after over 30 days on the mountain, the survivors of the snowshoe party had the strength to finally stagger into the valley below. And the first people they saw, the ones who helped these half-dead survivors, giving them food and shelter, were people from the Miwok village they stumbled into, who had no idea the party they were helping had murdered and eaten two of their own people just days before.
And it's something that our communities and the state, the nation at large, really need to have a reckoning with. How do we tell these stories, you know?
Once the survivors made it to John Sutter's fort, news of the disaster spread like wildfire. A rescue had to be mounted, but ensuring the safe return of that many people would cost money. An open letter from Sutter's fort asking for help was written to the people of San Francisco, and it was read aloud in the dining room of one of the city's hotels. Pre-Gold, San Francisco was not a big town, and some of those people listening to that letter had actually been on the emigrant trail with the Donner Party before they took that fateful cutoff. As Eliza Donner wrote in her memoir, to these folks safe and warm in that hotel, this glimpse into what might have been their fate was horrifying.
The misfortunes which had since befallen the party seemed incredible.
While San Francisco was digging into its pockets, remember James Reed, the guy who'd shot and killed a man on the trail and been banished from the wagon party? His exile had saved his life. He'd made his way safely to California, knowing his wife and children were running out of food fast. And now he was fundraising for a rescue mission too. Meanwhile, back at Sutter's Fort, a tiny ragtag rescue party was scrambled and sent up into the mountains first. But by the time they finally reached the camps in February 1847, 13 people there had already died. And the people they found still living were essentially living under the snow, says Greg at Donner Memorial State Park.
The cabins stood maybe 10 feet high. So 13, 15 feet of snow, the cabins were buried. What they saw were plumes of smoke coming out of a hole in the snow. And their first human contact was a woman crawling up out of a hole in the snow, kind of like coming out of a gopher hole.
One of the men in that rescue party remembered how a gaunt, delirious woman asked him, "Are you men from California, or do you come from heaven?" That first rescue party was just 7 men. All they could do was distribute a little food among the survivors and then lead the ones who could walk out of the camps. But this was no medevac to safety. This was the start of a days-long march over the mountains, through snowdrifts as high as buildings. In these desperate conditions, and still lacking enough food, several of them died on the rescue route. Back at the camps, the members of the Donner Party left behind returned despondently to their rotting, dark cabins. Eliza Donner, one of those left, recalled the desperation for food. Any food.
The little field mice that had crept into camp were caught then and used to ease the pangs of hunger. Even the bark and the twigs of pine were chewed in the vain effort to soothe the gnawings, which made one cry for bread and meat.
And then, in Patrick Breen's diary, comes the first mention of cannibalism at the camp, after the death of a young man named Milt.
Friday, February 26th, 1847. Mrs. Murphy said here yesterday that she thought she would commence on Milt and eat him.
In her memoir, Eliza Donner confirmed the fact that the flesh of the dead was used to sustain the living. But not, she said, until mothers had watched their children eat the very last of the food the first rescue team had brought them. And until wolves had dug up the bodies of the Donner Party's dead that were buried beneath the snow.
Perhaps God sent the wolves to show Mrs. Murphy, and also Mrs. Graves, where to get sustenance for their dependent little ones. Was it culpable or cannibalistic to seek and use the only life-saving means left them?
It was 2 weeks until a second rescue party arrived, led by none other than James Reed, who'd finally raised the cash and found enough men in San Francisco to retrieve his family. This time, 17 people were evacuated, leaving only a few of the Donner Party behind. This included most of the Donner family themselves at their creek camp, which had become a horrific sight of death and bodies. Another 2 weeks later, a third rescue party arrived and evacuated the remaining Donner children, including Eliza. After surviving being stuck in an incredible blizzard, right where Sugar Bowl Ski Resort is now, Eliza recalls reaching the safety of the Sacramento Valley 5 months after they'd first been stranded in the Sierras.
There, we caught the first breath of springtide, touched the warm, dry earth, and saw green fields far beyond the foot of that cold, cruel mountain range.
Only a handful of the Donner Party were now left behind at the camps, walking skeletons kept barely alive by human flesh. The ones who'd either been too weak to travel or refused to leave, like Eliza Donner's own mother, who wouldn't leave her sick husband and watched her children depart without her. The very last rescuers who made it to Donner Lake in April 1847 were really only making the journey for the salvage. After almost half a year of survival by 81 people, the landscape that greeted these rescuers was one of total horror. Body parts, including heads, were reportedly strewn around the snow. They found one last survivor, injured and completely alone up there. This was a man called Louis Kiesberg, whose family had been brought out by the first rescue party 2 months before. Although the rescuers couldn't help noticing that Kiesberg was now in possession of a great deal of the Donner family's goods and coins. Kiesberg was half dragged out of the camp along the same frozen path to freedom his family had taken weeks before. A path he didn't know his little girl had actually died on. Stopping to rest, he saw a piece of cloth sticking up from the snow, says Greg at Donner Memorial State Park.
So he grabs it with both hands and he yanks it, and he exhumes the body of his own daughter who had died with the rescue party going out earlier.
It's a ghastly ending to a horrific saga. But as the last of the Donner Party was brought down from the mountains and a silence settled over Donner Lake once more, California's dark reckoning with this disaster and what it would reveal was only just beginning.
Reporter Carly Severn. This episode features a song created by Chairman Jesus Tarango Jr. of Wilton Rancheria and his mother and former chairwoman, Mary Tarango. Big thanks to you both and everyone at Wilton Rancheria who advised us on this episode. This was part one of our special on the Donner Party. In part two, we explore the impact this had on California. And if you're a survivor of an infamous cannibal disaster, where do you go from there? The best part is you don't have to wait for part two. It is already out now. Find it in the Bay Curious podcast feed. We've also got photos and even more details from this unbelievable part of California history online. Visit baycurious.org and check things out. Bay Curious is made in San Francisco at member-supported KQED. I'm Olivia Allen Price.
Hi, Bay Curious listeners. Are you ready to play April's trivia game? Every month, we'll read a question here at the end of our episode. You can give us your answers over at our website, kqed.org/baycurious, or just click the link in the episode description. Out of the correct answers, we'll randomly choose one lucky winner to receive an awesome prize package with Bay Curious swag and Sierra Nevada goodies. Okay, our question for the month is, during the gold rush, the most valuable mine in the entire state was in the Bay Area. But it wasn't a gold mine. What were they mining, and where was the mine? Our trivia quiz is made possible by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Good luck!